You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read. The cow goes moo.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and my guest today is Kevin Killian, a co-author of a recent literary biography of Jack Spicer. The biography is called Poet Be Like God. The subtitle is Jack Spicer and the San Francisco Renaissance. And I want to begin by asking you to give me a mini bio of Jack Spicer. Who is he?
Jack Spicer was born in Hollywood in 1925. At age 20, he went to University of California at Berkeley and met two other would-be poets, Robert Duncan and Robin Blazer. And the three of them at that point, all very young men, tried to invent a new kind of poetry that would be just as good as the poetry of the then aging modernists, Eliot Pound, Marianne Moore, and so on, who were all 30, 40 years their senior. And Spicer went on to found his own poetry school in San Francisco, where he wrote 12 extraordinary books of poetry and died very young of drink in 1965. He was only 40 years old.
Now, so many things come out of the so-called Berkeley Renaissance, but the first thing I knew, even before picking up your biography, that this all came together in a nearly legendary poetry workshop that Spicer conducted called the Magic Workshop. And I wanted to ask you what they mean by poetry as magic.
The so-called magic workshop happened in 1957, and Spicer was newly returned from the East Coast, a place he despised. He came to San Francisco and talked the people at the public library into letting him have a room where he could invite young poets into a space where they could receive poetry from the outside world. Whether or not he really believed in magic or not, black and white magic, he persuaded many that he did, and he invited them to try their own hands at it by, among other exercises in the poetry workshop, you were invited to create your own language. You were invited to write a poem of blasphemy, to make yourself the king of the world and dictate to your subjects, to translate out of imaginary languages back and forth between all languages of the world, to rewrite the work of others, and to explore your own sexuality in a way that was almost inconceivable in the otherwise straight-laced 1950s.
I think whether or not there's a literal belief in black and white magic spelt with a K, Aleister Crowley style, it seems inevitable that somehow the books that were in the background here for Duncan, for Spicer, are in a sense magic or mystic books, whether they're low culture like the Oz books or avant-garde culture like the books by Mary Botts, that there is some level at which the poem is meant to cause a spell to take place that alters reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that, oddly enough, there is some before the self realm which the poet has access to, and he is dictated the poem. He doesn't write it. He receives a form of dictation. This seems to be something of the, way of judging the authenticity of a poem. Does it seem to have been dictated from elsewhere? Has the poet been made into a vessel? Has the poet been altered by carrying the poem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Spicer believed, you know, again, in contraindication to the prevalent poetic theory of the time, which was had been laid down by the American and British New Critics, that the poem isn't a vessel for personal expression. And he gave a lecture once and said, you know, if you have something to say, then write a letter to the editor. Don't write a poem.
And yet some of his poems oddly take the form of letters to the editor, or at least there's a whole book of his. What is it called? The book of...
Admonitions, maybe.
Yes, there's that. And then the book that he likes to put together because the poems have been rejected by the editors of various prestigious journals of modern poetry.
Spicer's final book is called The Book of Magazine Verse.
And these poems are printed in the page styles of the magazines that rejected them.
Mm-hmm.
There's the sense very much of the scene as rendered in your biography and the poems themselves as being retaliations and causers of dispute, vindictivenesses penned into a kind of ecstasy. Throughout the book, there are fights that become almost memorial fights, an attack on something Robert Duncan wrote called the Venice Poem, in which Spicer began shouting out loud at a reading that the poem was unacceptable, and Duncan acknowledging later on that it was Spicer's adversity that helped to form him as a poet, that mm-hmm. he needed the opposition. And then later on still, and mentioned at length in your epilogue, a war over translation, what it is, whether it should be accurate, whether it should be, whether the original should be treated like Martian language and you can translate it any way you will. So in what ways was contentiousness and attempts, I think, magically to possess the spirit of another, the rule of poetry in San Francisco within the Berkeley Renaissance?
First of all, they wouldn't, the three main writers in this group, the Berkeley Renaissance, Duncan, Spicer, and Blazer, who had a perfectly amicable friendship for many years that later dissolved in acrimony, wouldn't have cared if they didn't believe, all three of them, that poetry was the absolute most important thing in life. It meant everything to Spicer, and he, in a way, you might say, sacrificed his life to writing. For him, it was very important that you be true to your to the poem that's coming to you, and he distrusted all those who faked it, who sold out to the big presses, who published their poetry outside of the narrow city limits of San Francisco, because poetry is given to the local, not to the global. Furthermore, Spicer alone believed that great writing is produced in as a byproduct of acrimony and war and hatred, and the more bad feeling, the better the writing is going to be. And this was a development that set him apart from the poets, another school of poets writing in San Francisco in the U.S. at the time, the beat poets.
Who were writing out of friendship.
Perhaps, yeah.
A celebration
right.
of
love,
friends.
Mystic Buddha, you know, incense, the scripture of the golden eternity. Spicer was often confused with the beat poets, and he hated that confusion, and would be appalled today to see that he's still being confused with the beat writers.
Well, he is described by you and by others as a very lonely and often hated man. His difficulty with cleaning himself, not the least of many social difficulties. And Robert Duncan seems to make a useful, if terrifying, distinction. He says that Duncan and others seem to have confused love with longing for love. And I wondered if you could talk about that, the isolateness that the various figures in your biography crucially feel.
Mm-hmm. Jack Spicer was, I think he's really cute, you know, in the pictures of him, but the eyewitnesses of the time say he had like a terrible self-image. He was 6 feet tall but hunched over so badly he looked like he maybe was 5'4". Big, overgrown, kind of heavy forehead and little beady eyes, little hands, and he just despaired of ever finding a lover. And aren't those the people who love most deeply? And so his poetry became, despite his reprimands to others not write about personal subjects, his poetry is often a very moving description of a lifelong search for love.
But Duncan's distinction seems to be that the search for love is not the same as love, and that the search for love can be an addiction to loneliness.
You're probably right. At one point, Jack Spicer got a chance to meet one of his great idols, Marianne Moore, who came to San Francisco to give a reading in her old age, and he approached her with a poem he had written for her, and later he got this treasure from her, a postcard in the mail from Brooklyn, and she said, "Your problem is that you've conflated, you've confused solitude with loneliness, and the poet should work in solitude but not in loneliness."
Oh, it's sort of amazing because you comment that this, in fact, came from an article she was preparing at the time of advice for teenagers in which she advised them...
Don't go steady before it's time. You're just lonely. Yeah, if Spicer had only known, he would have been crushed, I believe.
I'm speaking to Kevin Killian, the co-author with Lewis Ellingham of Poet Be Like God, Jack Spicer and the San Francisco Renaissance, published by Wesleyan University Press. Now, I wanted to make a couple of distinctions. The book makes a big distinction between the Berkeley Renaissance and the San Francisco Renaissance, which, according to Spicer, never existed. Could you explain that?
The poets who gathered in Berkeley as young students in the immediate post-war period jokingly referred to their own, you know, student attempts and very ambitious ones to create a great literature as the Berkeley Renaissance, knowing how foolish that title was. Nevertheless, when 10 years later the Beat Revolution happened in San Francisco and people like Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac began mining what they felt was the exact their own properties, then the Berkeley Renaissance poets dismissed the pretensions of the new San Francisco Renaissance, which was being proclaimed everywhere. As far as they were concerned, Ginsberg, Kerouac were a bunch of New Yorkers who did not understand California ways, but were there to exploit their ideas.
One of the fascinating things about your biography, Poet Be Like God, is that when I became aware that the work I know of Duncan and Spicer, that they start to get published well after their formative work was done. And so it's very hard, for instance, to find the Venice poem.
Mm-hmm.
And in Spicer's case, the years during which he had risen to prominence in Berkeley as a poet, these are with poems that he rejected later and did not allow to be reprinted. Am I getting this correct?
That's right.
And it is at the point of a breakthrough book. What is it called?
After Lorca?
Yes, in which not only does he conceive suddenly not of a poem, but groups of poems, something, by the way, that people say that Yeats did as well, that the poems studied separately are not to be taken at face value. It's only in relation to a cosmos of other poems in the same book. But it seems to me that Spicer quotes from Yeats quite a bit, and mm-hmm. it may be an intuition that he perceived in reading Yeats. But it's the book as the suite of poems, and B, that one can write after a poet rather than translate that poet. Could you make that distinction for me? What does it mean?
When Spicer wrote after Lorca, it was a great breakthrough for him because of these two concurrent, you know, flashes of brilliance. The invention of the serial poem, the intricate, the poem that doesn't stand on its own, it must be read in relation to all the other poems that exist around it within the book, was for him a, although it had been sketched out before by the works of various different American and European poets, for him, he said, I'm going to do only books of poems from now on, and therefore I want my early lyric single poems to be, you know, burnt, you know, buried and forgotten. At the same time, after Lorca represented for him the beginning of poetry of dictation, in which he became a passive vehicle and let Lorca, the Spanish poet who had died in the Civil War some 20 years before, just speak through him and rewrite his many of his famous poems through Spicer's voice, a Californian-American, very like a hip cat voice. And to the degree that after Lorca succeeds as a really remarkable translation of Lorca, it's really an accident. After a while, the poems creep from being translations of Lorca to Spicer's own imitations and inventions, so they cannot be told apart anymore.
So up until after Lorca, what were the poems that he wrote just before? Were those the imaginary elegies?
Mm-hmm. The imaginary, he realized that he had indeed written a serial poem and without even knowing it. The four rather lengthy elegies for his youth that he called the imaginary elegies, which took 7 years to write.
I want listeners to be able to hear a historic recording. This is Jack Spicer reading from an early draft of the imaginary elegies. Bear in mind, this is, you know, a presentation of a tape from 1957, is
mm-hmm.
it? And so the sound quality is not great, but we will hear one piece, one elegy.
Imaginary elegy number 3. Then there is a sudden stop. The day changes. There is an innocent old sun, quite cold in clouds. The ache of sunshine stops. God is gone. God is gone. Nothing was quite as good. It's getting late. Put on your coat. It's getting dark. It's getting cold. Most things happen in twilight. When the sun goes down and the moon hasn't come and the bats are flying. Most things happen when God isn't looking. When God is blinking between good and evil and the bats are flying. Most things happen in twilight when things are easy and God is blind as a gigantic bat. The boys stretched out above the swimming pool receive the sun. Their groins are pressed against the warm cement. They look as if they dream, as if their bodies dream. Unblind the dreamers, for they ache with sun. Wake them with twilight. They're like lobsters now, hot, red, and private while they dream. They dream about themselves. They dream of dreams about themselves. They dream of dreams about themselves. Splash them with sunset like a wet bat. Unblind the dreamers. Poet, be like God.
That was Jack Spicer reading from the Imaginary Elegies. He is the subject of a biography by my guest, Kevin Killian, the co-author of Poet Be Like God, Jack Spicer, and the San Francisco Renaissance. Now, do you think that Spicer lives today in current San Francisco poetry?
The irony, of course, is that when Spicer died, really a broken man, just about unpublished and laughed at by many. And that today all of his work is back in print. There are many, many poets who have adopted him as their own particular hero. You know, say he was 30 or 40 years ahead of his time as far as his, you know, as his theory into poetic dictation, into linguistics, because he was a trained linguist, his mixing of the personal and the political, and, you know, his interest in science fiction and every kind of poetic thing that's going on today, he thought of and worked very, very beautifully in the late 50s and the early 60s. It's ironic that he would be so highly thought of today. At the same time, he was neglected for many years and became a cult figure. Poets know who he is, or many of us do, but maybe the general public doesn't, because he's been relegated to the kind of creepy cult figure status. And until one breaks out of that, one doesn't get a chance really to affect the culture that one wants, that one would have liked to. So that has yet to happen. Hopefully these new publications on Spicer will do something about that.
I'm talking to Kevin Killian, the author of one of these new publications on Spicer, a really exciting biography called Poet Be Like God, Jack Spicer and the San Francisco Renaissance, published by Wesleyan University Press. I feel that if you don't know Spicer's work but have an interest in poetry, it's one of two books that really gives you the sense of what it is like for young poets to play with and claw and paw one another on their way up to the top, as everyone jokes.
Or to the bottom.
To the bottom. There is so little money in poetry that there's a lot of prize fighting there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of those books that could only, in a sense, be written now. Like Brad Gooch's Life of Frank O'Hara, Kevin Killian's Poet Be Like God about Jack Spicer gives you that whole area both of aesthetic wars and gradual development, but also of gender preference wars. And since these enter, in fact, the subject of the poetry, who is your muse, male or female? How does he, she inseminate you with a poem? Who are the poems dedicated to? And is there for a poem a sex act between the poet and his dedicatee? In Spicer's view, very often, and very often the gift of a book of poetry was a love act. And so you've got, for the first time, the ability to read books now that the poets' families are not as terrified. You won't read about T.S. Eliot in the same way that you can read about more recent poets, because we have different standards of what can be told, what is and isn't, or isn't to remain private. What were your difficulties in writing this biography in terms of the boundary between what can be made public and what remains private?
Oh, dear. Of course, we were very lucky because Lou Ellingham, my co-author, had known Spicer and was privy to a lot of the colloquy around him and was part of his school as a very young man. When I came upon his material 8 years ago, I said, can we really say these things about these people who are still alive? Well, in the interim, some of the people have died. That makes things easier, Michael. I can write a whole new book when a certain X, Y, and Z die, but what can I say? But the true difficulties in writing a biography are that one wants to write something that's true in every line, and I'm a novelist, and I'm a poet, and I'm a playwright, and I'm an art writer, and so forth. And I had to bring all of my gifts in all these fields to writing this book because they demand all of it. Would I ever write another biography again? I don't think so. It's too much work. The difficulty was to show, why is it important to read a book on Jack Spicer? Well, first of all, you have to show that he is an important American poet. Secondly, you have to show that he was important not only in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, in California, but in a national and an international level. And then to present what might appear to be the squabblings of a bunch of very gifted and neurotic homosexual men against a worldwide backdrop of Cold War politics, of national security, of the McCarthy hearings, the fear of being homosexual in the U.S. in the 50s and 60s, and a waves upon waves of anti-Semitism, racism, and misogyny that ruled our cultural life in these periods. So a cultural studies approach was difficult for me to work through, but I finally tried to do that.
I've been speaking to Kevin Killian, the co-author with Lewis Ellingham of Poet Be Like God. Now, it is so often difficult to find books about poetry, serious books, in your general neighborhood bookstore. To repair this difficulty, a nonprofit organization called Small Press Distribution exists. It has an 800 number, which is 1-800-869-7553. Once again, 1-800-869-7553. And Kevin's biography of Jack Spicer, as well as a recent publication of the collected lectures of Jack Spicer, The House That Jack Built, can be ordered from them, as well as books of poetry by Spicer, as well as members of the Berkeley and or San Francisco Renaissance. A very good thing to know about Small Press Distribution. Kevin, I want to thank you for being on the show with me today.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel, and the engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance today from Alan Howard, development by Beverly Walker. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.